Welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante along with T. Frank Carr. T. Frank, how are we doing today?
Doing all right. How you doing, Jim?
Very good, very good. We are smack dab in the middle of the off season, but last week, a lot of activity around the team, coaches meeting with the media, Lift for Life going on. And I'll tell you what, we had a commitment last week. You and I didn't get a chance to talk about it. I'd like to hear more about it. Darius Dixon, a very highly regarded cornerback out of California, yep, makes his commitment. T. Frank, first of all, was this a surprise commitment?
Yeah. In the era of nothing's really a surprise because we have experts that track all this stuff all the time, and we knew he was coming and we knew there was a good relationship, but not necessarily one that, I think when you've got somebody coming from one of the top five programs in America, that's also in California, it is a surprise. So yeah, I guess in the end, if you're going to weigh the pros and cons, the short answer long is, yeah, it was a surprise for sure.
Yeah, you mentioned one of the top programs in the country, that's Matter Day, which just churns out Division I players.
Yep, yeah, great program, a lot of talent in Southern California. It's a school that produces a lot of USC commits and a lot of guys that have gone on to the NFL, you know, prestigious, wins a lot of titles and things like that. So you might see, if you're going to see a high school game on ESPN, it's going to be a modern day game for sure. Or an IMG game.
Yes, there's the handful of schools like that. Matter Day, first of all, it's just amazing for Penn State, James Franklin, to get a player from California and from a school like that. You hope that opens up future opportunities. But let's talk first about Darius Dixon. As I said, cornerback, I believe he's the highest ranked player in this recruiting class. Very good get. What could you tell us about Darius Dixon? I didn't realize that was funny, T. Frank.
Okay, so, but this is the conversation and sort of the debate we've been having over at BlueWhiteIllustrated.com on the message board of, is he the highest rated recruit? Is he the elite cornerback? Because there's some nuance to his recruitment and there's some nuance to his evaluation. So let me just give you what On3 has. The On3 industry ranking, 92 overall, number 135 in the country, 14th ranked cornerback, 13th player in California. So that's all very good. Other places, he's anywhere as high as 53. But at On3, we have him as a 3-star and an 89 overall. And there's a reason for that in his profile. There's a reason for that in his huddle highlights. There's a reason for that in his testing numbers and all of that stuff. So I think there is a split perception on this is a starter for modern day who plays corner, has great ball production, but how is he getting that ball production? What is he asked to do? And does he do certain things? That's when I took a look at his film, a deep dive on the modern day defense and how he's used. I do come back with kind of a mixed reaction of this is a very good corner. This is a very good football player. That's the start. At no point is this a bad football player. Is this a bust or any of those things? But is he a top 8 player at his position? I don't know that that's true either. So there is some nuance to the conversation about Darius Dixon in all of these evaluations.
What are the questions on him?
Mostly it deals with speed. So he does not have 100 meter dash time from this year. And the one he had from his sophomore year, it was not to the level of an elite corner. He went to an Under Armour camp in Los Angeles and ran a laser timed. He ran in the 4.6s, the high 4.6s. So that right there is a, I don't want to say red flag, but these are indicators that you need to then look on the film and say, okay, what does he do? Does he have the speed to play Division I cornerback and be an elite player that eventually goes on and plays the same position in the NFL. And the thing that I found is there's very few examples in his highlight film specifically of him playing press man coverage, where he's at the line of scrimmage, he's got a mirror and he's got a match and he's got a run with receivers down the field. That, when I took a look at the defense, is a little bit a part of the scheme, but also indicating how they run things, because they run a real man coverage system. And the way I described it is, in man coverage, you have your number one corner on the outside who has the number one receiver. The number two has the number two. The number three has the number three. Usually that's like a safety or somebody who's covering a slot somebody on the inside. So if you label from the outside, one, two, three, the receiver's going in towards the tackle formation. That's how man coverage works. And from there, the offense can, you know, go all different directions. So you have different rules about how you cover those guys. And maybe your outside corner always stays on the outside and your inside corner always stays on the inside and blah, blah, blah. Modern day goes, hey, you've got number 17. So wherever 17 goes, you go with him. So that creates some disadvantages from a schematic perspective that they have to overcome. So they run very deliberate levels to their coverage. So you've got a slot corner nose to nose with a receiver. You've got another corner who's 5 yards off the line of scrimmage. And then you've got Dixon, typically, who's 8 to 10, so that you don't have these guys running into each other. Because that's the point of bump coverage. That's the point of rub routes and things like that. So there is a little bit of explanation on why he's playing so much off coverage. But at the same time, if you go, okay, who does he have? Rarely does he have the fastest guy on the other team from an obvious perspective. He lines up in the slot a good bit. And he also is a versatile player that sometimes lines up at safety, or if they're running a coverage umbrella where he is now a secondary player that's in zone instead of in man coverage, he can sometimes find himself filling the run like a safety. There's two sides of that. There's the obvious thing we just started with, which is he fast enough? Is he the guy that they're going to put up against the number one receiver from a speed perspective on the other side? And then who are they trusting to do the hard stuff? He's a very smart football player. The way they ask him to play the game is demanding from a mental standpoint, and he's very good at what he does. But those are the context, and I think, you know, if I were to interpret Charles Power as the director of recruiting for On3, and he does all of our rankings, I know generally how he thinks from having conversations with him and reading kind of his analysis of players. So if he's not seeing number one corner material, that's why he is where he is. But the other services are not wrong. This is a very good football player and has a high floor and potentially a high ceiling at the position.
Who were the main competitors to get him?
I believe Washington and Tennessee were the other two schools that were going to get official visits, and he decided to end his recruitment after going to Penn State for his official visit. What was this, 2 weekends ago now? You don't always want to look at that, but it is another indicator of, okay, modern day corner, number one corner on the team, like a starting corner. Where's Alabama? Where's USC in this conversation? Where is Oregon? Yeah. So that gives you some indication again of kind of building this roster of information that I think this is a very valuable player in Tom Allen's defense, because Penn State's going to let him play corner, and I think that's the right move because he has such a good understanding of zone concepts and breaking on the ball. He's incredibly productive. Like, this is a guy who they trusted in a lot of different situations to fill against the run, to play off coverage and attack the ball underneath, and to get interceptions and to fully understand route concepts and things like that. And he was not just good, but was very productive. So he can play corner for Penn State, but I also think if you want him to play field safety, if you want him to play the lion position, now that you have a five defensive back philosophy, if that's what they want to build for the future, he gives you the versatility in this class to say, we're going to start him at corner and we can take as many corners as we want, because we know if he gets beat out in that room, which is deep with young players right now, he's not a failure because we can just move him to a different position and he can be a high level field safety. He can maybe even play the boundary. I think he needs to get a little stronger against the run. He's willing, but there's some tackling techniques and fundamentals, and you know, he doesn't relish contact, even though he's brave and, you know, sticks his face in anywhere. It doesn't always look the way it should, I guess. So it's a long way to say this is a guy who can play four, if not five, positions in the secondary. Again, a very valuable thing. But if you were saying this is the 53rd overall player in the country and he is a top five corner, I don't know that he has a complete skill set to fill that out. But is he a top 300 player? I agree with that. I think that we have him a little underrated. I think we swung the other way a little too far on this because he has such a high floor from an intelligence and a football playing perspective. And he's not slow. The other thing is, and this is the last thing, about the analysis of the defense. Modern day's defensive line is so ridiculously overpowered that it's impossible to find situations on a regular basis. I didn't go through every single game, you know, during his junior season, but it's hard to find examples of the defensive line not getting immediate pressure and putting these corners in a position where they have to cover a guy for long enough to create those situations where you would see him stressed from a speed perspective. His technique is good enough that if it's not going through some ridiculous traffic of three receivers trying to pick him down the field vertically, I think he's a pretty good player of staying with his man and staying in the hip pocket, staying in phase. So I don't even have great examples of this guy isn't fast enough. It's just a part of the profile we know about, we have data on, but when you look on the field, it is hard to find examples of him losing for speed. And yet when you look at him on the field, you go, I don't know how fast this guy is. You don't see like that eye popping. Oh, wow, he's so fast. So it is just there is this obscure kind of opaque thing about his recruiting profile that I find endlessly fascinating. I've talked about this for almost 11 minutes straight. And I feel like, you know, we have even scratched the surface on the distinctions here between how he's viewed by one group of people and how he's viewed by another.
Well, you also have a situation. You mentioned the speed being less than optimal. We had a cornerback here by the name of Kalen King who had the fantastic year at that speed. The following year, we were all disappointed in his performance and said, gee, he's not fast enough. Well, he was certainly fast enough the prior year.
And he can get faster. That's another thing that Penn State has shown. Not everybody can run in the 4.4s, but if you're 6'1", you play with great technique. You're smart, as you talked about, anticipation. You play with those tenets and you run in the 4.5s. You can be a corner that plays, and especially at the college level. There's no barring on that. It's just kind of the long-term like NFL projection on that.
Very good, T. Frank. That's it for quarter one. Lots more to get to when we come back.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.
It's quarter number two on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number two. He's T. Frank Carr. I'm Jim Galante. We're talking Penn State football. Hey, Frank, we spent quarter number one talking about Darius Dixon, the cornerback from California. Before we just wrap up that conversation, I had one last question. We were talking about speed, especially as we were wrapping up. And you gave his high, I think you said high 4.6s he was timed at his sophomore year. My question just in general about speed, how much does that change for a high school player? That's a sophomore you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Are those years, you know, in high school from sophomore year to senior year, do you typically see an uptick in speed, or what you see is what you get that sophomore year typically?
So I don't want to say specifically that the time came from his sophomore year. I don't know the exact date of the Under Armour camp. It could have been his sophomore before his junior season, or it could have been this spring. I don't actually have that particular piece of information. But generally, two things about this are true. Laser timed are always slower. So for those, this is a common question that people get asked is like, what's the difference between a laser time and a different type of 40? So a laser time is you start the moment you break the laser at the start of your 40, and the moment you end and you break the laser at the end of your 40, that's your time. And the nuance and the understanding is that you can break that laser at the beginning and not be moving forward. So your technique is super important. How you use your hands, your starting, because if your momentum is going forward and you are breaking that while you're in stride, that's different. But if you lean and lurch, or if you swing your arm improperly, or whatever happens, starts that, and that can put a tenth of a second on your time. So generally, you know, my coworkers have talked about, if you see a laser time, subtract a tenth of a second, because a hand time is a little more forgiving, where they go on the motion of movement, not necessarily on your hair broke the laser. And so Penn State works on hand times, I believe. And then there are other situations where you do a hand start and a laser finish or something like that. So you have a stopwatch and then it starts the timer and then the laser finishes the timer. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can do this. And that's when we say that a laser start and a laser finish is the most unforgiving part of this. On top of that, we talk about getting faster at Penn State and the strength and development program. Again, you can maybe shave for guys that can. I would say a guy coming from modern day, probably closer to his ceiling than a guy who is coming from Westlake, somewhere in wherever, you know, upstate New York guy, right? So somebody coming from a different situation. That guy might be closer from a speed training perspective and a fitness training perspective, that he is not going to get dramatic gains at Penn State, but he is going to physically develop from 17 to 21. He will get faster. So that is the conversation of, it's, you're just not working with a guy who's going to be in the low 4.4s at 6.1. This is a guy who might be getting in the high 4.4s eventually.
Very good. All right, let's move on. A great event also occurred last week, and that's the annual Lift for Life. And it's for a very good cause. We all know that. That's great. But it also gives us a peek at the players doing athletic things. Mm-hmm. You see them competing in shorts and t-shirt. You get to see the bodies. What stood out to you at the Lift for Life event? What players stood out?
The tight ends are huge. So the tight ends walk around like you would think a – that room, we talk about them all as freaks, right? Like, we talk about these guys that are 6'5", 240-plus pounds, and run really well. And then you're like, yeah, I understand that. I know that. And then you see them all together, and you see them walking next to other positions, and it's like a Mr. Universe contest. Like, Andrew Rapelier has gotten thicker, and, like, I don't know what his current weight is, but that dude from the neck down is stacked. And honestly, not even the neck. Like, he's got that whole cowboy collar built into his neck. Luke Reynolds looks really impressive for a freshman. Jerry Cross, we don't talk enough about Jerry Cross. They were doing a medicine ball toss, and Jerry is unbelievably powerful, athletic, strong, big, everything you want. He's never available. So we'll have to see how he factors in. And then you've got Joey Schlaffer, who underrated here, has a Theo Johnson frame where he's tall, he's big, and he still has a lot of room to grow. So he's probably in the 240s. I think by the time he's done growing, he could be 260-ish in that range if he fully develops the way that I think he can. So, like, the initial offering of who stood out, the tight ends are huge. And they're all super young. I didn't even pay attention to Tyler Warren. Like, he's the biggest of them at this point.
Well, he's the given. And, you know, a couple notes at tight end. First of all, no surprise how good they are. We talk about that. They were good, they are good, and they're going to be good. Okay. Mm-hmm. They just keep churning them out. You and I got to chat with Joey Schlaffer a couple weeks ago, and just big. But yeah, as you were describing him, I was in my head saying to myself, yeah, but he could be bigger.
Oh yeah.
And oh, yeah. You could see how he could carry more weight. And the final note, and it's something that Landon and I have talked about quite a bit in our conversation, and I hope people understand why this impresses me so much. Landon and I were talking about the football players playing basketball, and he said he thought Tyler Warren might be the best basketball player on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a tight end who's what, like 260, to be considered the best basketball player,
yeah,
that tells me how athletic he is.
Oh yeah,
at that size, to me, that's an incredible statement about him, T. Frank.
Yeah, I would agree. That's kind of the thesis of this is they we'll see what happens with this particular recruiting class, where they've had a lot of these top tight ends that have gone elsewhere this cycle. Matt Henderson fits into that group. He's a casual 6'5". I always am shocked every time I see him. But they just find these guys that have seemingly unlimited growth potential and great athleticism. So, you know, it's a position of strength in Andy Kolonicki's offense that I think is going to pay more dividends than it has in the past.
And yes, and I think just take advantage of it. You've got these players, you've got these weapons, take advantage of them. How did the wide receivers look? I know I read one article that won the tug of war against the defensive backs, T. Frank, so I guess that's a good thing. How did the wide receivers look? Anything stand out to you?
No, but that's because I wasn't paying attention to them. Like, I was going in with a specific mission. I was looking for the freshmen to get photos of them, so I was kind of passing over some of them. I did see Tysier Denmark was there. Got some photos of Tysier Denmark. I didn't see him run or move, so if you want any sort of like evaluation of him as an, I don't know. He got here probably this week, so he doesn't even have a number yet. So that I don't have a good answer for you on the receiver. I did see that tug of war, and it just was like it was over before I was really paying attention.
Well, I thought what was interesting in the article, it was kind of like the headline is the wide receivers beat the defensive backs. Yay. Oh, and by the way, Nick Singleton was with the wide receivers. So that might
helps.
Be. Yes, that certainly helps. You mentioned looking for the freshmen. I specifically was interested in the tackles.
Yeah.
You had the guys Garrett Sexton and Egan Boyer who came in undersized. And you had Donovan Harbor, who's a guy who probably needed his body reshaped a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see them? What kind of reaction did you have to them?
Yeah, I actually, so I talked to Chuck Losey. We got a chance to speak with this head strength coach before the event and just kind of picked his brain about the tackles and some of the players of that situation. And then I actually, if you want to go to BlueWhiteIllustrated.com, we got a special promo. You can sign up for $1 and you can check out this. I did a before and after. So last year, Phil Troutman had four of his five offensive linemen with him at the at a camp in June. And then I got pictures of all of them this past weekend or in the last week at Penn State Prospect Camp and then Lift for Life. And Donovan Harbor has made a significant transformation in his body. There's work to do. I still think he needs to cut a little more bad weight, but they did a kettlebell carry where, you know, they had like 100-pound kettlebells and they were going halfway through the end zone and back. And just when his muscles were activated, like he looks more fit. So his chest, his shoulders, his arms, you can see more definition than you saw when he was in high school. On the flip side, you have Egan Boyer, who doesn't look like a string bean anymore. He doesn't look big. Here's an important thing. He does not look big. He still looks like closer maybe to the tight end room, but he's looking more like an offensive lineman. And then Garrett Sexton, who put on a little too much weight in the winter, and then has suffered an injury, wasn't available for spring practice. I think he's back on track. I think that initial surge of trying to get too big too fast, he's been able to round that out. He's starting to look like an offensive lineman, but like a Penn State offensive lineman more so than a guy who is just big to be big. So I'm very optimistic about his long-term potential, because we talked about him as this dominant guy at 100 or 225 pounds, maybe 250 his senior season. He has already done the growing to get close. So now it's about refining that, turning that into that strength into power and that power into explosiveness. And he is on the right path from a size perspective. So I know with both of these guys, Egan Boyer and with Garrett Sexton, there were questions about their size coming in. I never really did, but I certainly don't have questions about Sexton now. And Boyer, I think he's on the right path.
One last offensive lineman. This is the redshirt freshman, Anthony Donka. And I bring him up only because our buddy Landon did and said, Jim, I saw him. He looks like Olu now.
I don't know what to say, because he's been a freak the whole time. Because like Landon's right. He walks around and you're like, oh, there's a guy going to the draft next year. And he's a redshirt freshman. And it just you kind of, it's that blindness you get when you're just used to something. And I've seen him enough times now that I'm used to seeing him. And I don't ever stop and think, no, this is not normal that he is that big and that athletic and moves that well and is that young. He's technique and all those things aside, I think no one stands to benefit more from this offense than him and Drew Shelton, from Andy Kolnicki and what he can do, accentuating the run game, accentuating their athleticism, getting them to move and to the second level and to do athletic things, and then to de-emphasize situations where they have to be technically perfect. So I'm optimistic about those guys, even though I'm still on the fence about Shelton. Runaway freight train of optimism for Anthony Donka.
All right, T. Frank, that's it for quarter number two. Stick around. We've got your questions, and we're going to ask T. Frank when we come back.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, general manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.
Let's get back to the action on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number three. That means it's time to ask T. Frank. We'll take your questions for T. Frank. And if you want to submit a question, all you got to do is download our app. That's Keystone Sports. Just search Keystone Sports. You'll see it. Download it. You'll see the Ask T. Frank button, and away you go. All right, T. Frank, here's we go. First question, Sam from Paoli says, T. Frank, first, I am not advocating for this, but...
Okay.
You'll understand why he said that. First, I'm not advocating for this, but... What would this offense look like with Bo Prabula as the starter? How do you think he would perform?
Well, I think he is built for this offense. So this is something we've talked about here on the show previously, is if you look at historically at Andy Kolnicki's offense, they have been athletic. I hate to use the term dual threat, but guys who can move. And then it's a varying degree of how much they use that tool. So I'll give you an example. I have been doing this past week a deep dive, going back to Wisconsin Whitewater to watch some of the film from Andy Kolnicki with Lance Leipold at their first stop together. And the quarterback there is not a dual threat necessarily from, and they're not using the read option the same way, but he's an athletic player that can break the pocket. He can run the football. He is mobile enough to create problems when you are not paying attention. So if you fast forward to what they did at Kansas, and they have a lot of mobile quarterbacks, and they're trying to make up for that deficit in talent by using the quarterback as an equalizer in the run game, you see more of the read option. So not to not answer your question, but the point of Andy Kolnicki's offense is what do we have to work with? How do we maximize that? Because even last year, I've talked about this, the cautionary tale here is Jason Bean was the starter for most of last year, even though Jalen Daniels was the starter to begin the season. I think there was an injury. I don't exactly know 100% the story there. But Jason Bean was an athletic guy who could throw the football, very courageous throwing it down the field, but was kind of that dual threat guy. By the end of the season, their third quarterback was coming on the field against Kansas State, and they were playing almost true triple option football. So the offense last year changed from the beginning to the end of the season based on what he was trying to emphasize. So the offense is dictated by who's playing. There's going to be an element of Bo Prabula running the football, but there's got to be an element of Bo Prabula throwing the football. And that's the wild card of how does he operate the dropback passing game? Because as much as I think this offense can de-emphasize that and make things easier for the quarterback, you have to still throw and catch. And you have to, at some point, it's third and seven, you can't use read option, you can't use RPOs, you've got to throw the football. And I think, again, people have taken Penn State's, I don't want to say unwillingness to have Bo throw the football, but just the option, the opportunity has not been prevalent for him to throw the football a lot. So people think he can't do that. I think he can throw the football. He's got a strong enough arm. I think he's, you know, the Trace McSorley comparisons are rampant, even by Trace McSorley and Christian Hackenberg. I think he can throw the football. He's maybe got a stronger arm. It's the decision-making of when to bail on a play and not put the ball in harm's way. I think that's Bo's biggest problem. That's kind of an anecdotal observation on my part, but I think it would look good. I think you've got two quarterbacks that can function in this offense maybe differently, but I think there's enough overlap that it doesn't matter. Both of those guys can, you can win with either of these guys.
I'm going to rephrase the question. I'm going to jump to 2025. Drew Aller has made the jump to the NFL. It now becomes Bo Prabula's team. Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would be comfortable with a competition too. I think that we overlook Jackson Smolak because I think he's got, if you want the guy who I think has the closest comparison to Trace McSorley from a mental perspective of that dude's a stone cold killer that you don't think is, he might have the most of that. But Bo Prabula and then Ethan Grunkmeyer, I'm very high on in terms of his total package from the mental, physical side of clutch plays, arm strength, throwing on the run, all of those tools. I think Penn State's well suited for quarterback competition after Drew Aller, whenever that happens, that they're going to have three good options. Whichever one wins, they're going to be able to build an offense around as long as they still have all the pieces and that NIL doesn't cut the roster, like, or whatever random thing could happen that Penn State takes a drop in talent. But I think that the quarterback room is as strong as it's been since I've been following Penn State and Penn State recruiting. This is a very strong room of offensive passers.
And I think Jackson gets overlooked, especially now that he's out with injuries.
Yeah.
That's, you know, obviously an issue. Let's go to Stan in Gaithersburg, who says, T-Frank, can you give me a player or two that you think will surprise fans this year in a good way?
Was it Stan?
Yes.
Yeah, Stan. I've been saying Caden Saunders for a while. I think that there was more there last year than he was able to do just because of the offensive situation. The antithesis of what Andy Kolnicki is going to do. It felt like last year they were force-feeding the ball to a handful of players without trying to get everyone involved while also accentuating those players, if that makes any sense. So I think that there's an opportunity for Caden Saunders to be that guy. And then pick your safety. Jalen Reed is going to be a huge part of this defense from a structural standpoint. He could be a glue guy that we don't see. He could be a guy that gets into the passing lanes and has multiple interceptions and has a Jair Brown-like season. And then, of course, KJ Winston, superstar abilities, superstar work ethic and all of those things. Talked to him the other day. His favorite NFL DBs at safety are Kyle Hamilton, Derwin James, the do-it-all player that can blitz, cover, and play in deep coverage. So a guy that can do it all. And then Zaki Wheatley is a guy who we know has a propensity for the football, and as long as his freelancing is over and he understands where he needs to be and how to do it and the dialed-in-ness is there, I think he's got as much talent as the other two. I've been very high on him in terms of his long-term projection as a guy who can play at 200 pounds, has a nose for the football, and can play both field and boundary. So I guess I'm having a hard time not running down the whole defense, because I think AJ Harris is another guy that you should be aware of, that I think we know of, but we don't know of. And then if you want a superstar ascendant guy, Tony Rojas to me is the difference. I think he's the best pure linebacker. Micah Parsons, best defensive player. Abdul Carter, best athlete. You know, qualifiers for those guys. The guy who could be the best linebacker and athlete and all those things together, the instincts, the coverage, everything. I am very high on Tony Rojas.
And I like that. I think you coined the phrase dialed inness.
If dialed inness.
Dialed inness. Very good, T. Frank. I will be using that. Let's see. Randy from Binghamton says, why is offensive line so tough to evaluate with high school recruits? Do you think this will create greater demand in the transfer portal to bring in more experienced and proved talent?
Yes, absolutely. It's the same in the NFL, where the transition is so hard. You can be a great athlete, and if you don't pay attention to the details of the position, you don't fall in love with the craft of pass blocking or run blocking technique, where your hands are, your leverage. Everything is specific. Everything is intentional. And if you think you're going to be big and strong and road grade people at the next level, whatever the next level is, you are vastly mistaken, unless you're like Larry Allen or, you know, some of the tackles, Orlando Pace, the kid from Oregon right now, Penei Sewell. Like, there are five guys I could come up with off the top of my head that can just go to the next level and be great. Everyone else has to do everything from an athletic standpoint and a technique standpoint, and you've got to be good at everything, where you might be an expert pass blocker, but you're an average run blocker. So that shows up. And in high school, you're coming from incredibly disparate backgrounds with incredibly disparate abilities and levels of education in football, where, you know, we talk about Javon Williams, five-star athlete who has never pass blocked before. So it took him a year and a half to learn how to pass block. And so it takes some time. It's just the most demanding position overall when you talk about athletic ability and mental ability that there is in football. So that's why it's hard. And the NFL, guys who get through their rookie deal, you spend 4 years developing an offensive lineman, and then somebody else signs him in free agency. That's kind of how it goes sometimes, because it's hard to evaluate offensive linemen outside of the obvious ones. And again, going back to the obvious ones, there are the obvious five-star guys that have all the talent and show all the technique, and they are coveted. And then from there, how do you find the traits, physical and mental, and then project those once they're bigger, stronger, faster, and older?
And I think the other part to it is just the physical aspect. In high school, offensive linemen are just often the biggest guys, and they're bigger than that opponent on the other side of the ball. Yep. And that's how they win the battle. The athleticism that you find in the quarterback and the running back, you may not find in the offensive lineman. Just like the offensive lineman we talked about earlier in the show, one guy, they had to change his body, you know, slim him down to build him back up. A couple other guys, they were long and lean. You had to put mass on them. So those are the differences. All right, here's kind of an interesting one for you, T. Frank. Tom from King of Prussia says, if we concede that Ohio State is the more talented team, what can Penn State, with their talent, do to make up for the talent gap when they play each other?
Tom, this is a great question, and I was thinking about this for a couple of weeks now. It's hiring Andy Kotelnicki, and it's hiring Tom Allen. So innovation happens at lower levels, where you have to overcome talent deficiencies because you can't recruit. You straight up cannot get guys at Wisconsin Whitewater that are consistently at a level to win through traditional means of, here's a basic inside zone, here's a basic man coverage, we're going to play simple and fast, and you're going to have to beat us. So you have to find winning in the margins. And Penn State did that with Joe Moorhead going to Fordham and finding a lot of success. They tried to replicate that with Ricky Ronnie and what he learned at Vanderbilt and under Joe Moorhead. And then they kind of wandered around for a while before they found Andy Kotelnicki, because it's hard to find these guys. And when you find a successful one, they become head coaches. This is the same thing with Lincoln Riley. Lincoln Riley is a head coach because he's a great offense coordinator and a great offensive mind that develops quarterback talent. So I think, to me, it's Andy Kotelnicki. It's winning in the margins. It's doing smart things to put your players in position to succeed and trying to schematically break the other team and overcome their advantages. Will it work? We don't know. But I think this is one of the better chances they've had, given the talent they have.
That's it, T. Frank, for quarter three. More to go. Stick with us for quarter four.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership, with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.
We head to the home stretch in quarter number four on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. He's T. Frank. I'm Jim. We just completed Ask T. Frank. And I always feel like that last question, a lot of times we shortchange it. Yeah. And it was the interesting question from Tom. He asked about how do you – it's one thing to beat a team that where you have at least comparable, if not better, talent. It's a little bit different when you're looking – you know, you're punching up a weight.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's much doubt Ohio State might have the most talent in the country.
Yes, they intentionally went out and got the most talent in the country. A great example, they have Travion Henderson, who is, some people have projected him as a first-round running back. Talented-wise, he's a top 60 player. Then they went out and got Quinshon Judkins from Ole Miss, just because they wanted a power back, I guess. So they just went out and bought, I don't think it's even a secret, they went out and NIL bought coaches and players to amass the most talent in the country. So absolutely. By the way, it was an excellent Ask T. Frank. Randy and Tom, great questions today.
Oh, we always like when that's the case. But going back to that, T. Frank, the use of the talent, I think this is where coaches make their bones, being able to overcome that. You know, the ultimate, and I always use this example, is the service academies and how they play the game.
Yep.
Because they know what they're up against and they change the nature of the game to their advantage. And can Penn State do that? You brought up Joe Moorhead. I think he was the example on the offensive side who he maximized the talent that Penn State had.
Yes, they had some great talent at that point, right? They had some really talented offensive skill players, but their offensive line was bad. Let's not sugarcoat it. It was bad. Now, they had an NFL starter. Again, they had select really good football players where they had an NFL starter in Connor McGovern. They had another guy who's a longtime NFL player that's bounced between starting and being a primary backup in Ryan Bates. But the offensive line is about five players playing together and being cohesive. They did not have five guys that were at the level of Ohio State, Michigan, and those teams, and they were able to scheme around that. Some of it is through Saquon Barkley being ridiculous, and some of it is because Trace McSorley was an excellent runner and an excellent decision maker, and they were able to, for the most part, overcome some of those things. The tough part here is that I think defensively, Jim Knowles is a guy who does that. Coming from Oklahoma State, coming from a situation where Ohio State also went out and tried to find guys who win in the margins because their defense was so bad before that they're trying to find those guys that know how to maximize the talent of their players. So Penn State going up against Ohio State and that defense being as good as it is, I don't know that the player talent level matched their production last year. This is a good defense. Don't get me wrong. A lot of guys that are going to go to the NFL, but they didn't have a Bosa, in my opinion. JT Tuimoloau, maybe a step back from that. They had some really good secondary players, but is there a Denzel Ward or some of the other players that have gone at corner, gone in the top five? Maybe eventually, but they were able to play above their abilities. So now Penn State needs to do that to a slightly higher degree because they need to be able to beat the talent and the scheme. Chip Kelly's interesting to me. I don't expect from there because it's a vastly, in my opinion, it's a vastly different offense than what they've been running with the offense they've had under Ryan Day. I think they want to get back to being a more power team, more quarterback run option, which again is about winning in the margins. It's about taking full advantage of scheme and box count and all of those things, as opposed to what they were doing before, which is, hey, we want to maximize our explosive plays through the receivers and throw the ball down the field, bombs away. You can't get past our tackles, and our receivers are faster, more athletic, bigger, just better than your secondary. And that, when they faced a team that was as good as them, you know, in the college football playoff, they lost because they were not maximizing these opportunities. So we'll have to see what they are doing with Chip Kelly. I've never been a huge fan of Chip Kelly, but I know that this is another one situation where T. Frank is wrong because the industry really respects Chip Kelly.
The only knock I will have on this Ohio State roster is the quarterback. And there's lots of depth there. They have like, what, four or five guys, I think four guys who were top 100 players as recruits, and they bring in an experienced guy in Howard from Kansas State.
Yeah.
So,
but again, he's more of a dual threat in terms of he can run a little bit better than some of the guys they've had recently, Kyle McCord specifically. So it brings that other element here that I think is important to know, talking about that matchup and talking about what they're maybe trying to do on offense.
And there's nothing that says that a transfer portal quarterback can't come right in and be exceptional. We've seen that over and over again. Just last year, Michael Penix, Bo Nix are perfect examples of it. But this isn't like when we have that returning quarterback who's done it at Ohio State.
Yep.
I'm probably nitpicking to find an issue with that team, but that's the closest I could find, T. Frank. Let's get back to the past week of Penn State football. James Franklin met the press, and just as a quick aside, and he's no different than most coaches. They talk a lot, don't necessarily say a whole lot. But I'm often critical of the media and the guys who have to cover Penn State day to day, the beat writers. I am actually amazed at how they could take some of the most innocuous comments and turn it into an entire article, T. Frank. So I will, and that's not a left-handed compliment. It's true. Because I've seen so many of them in the past week. But was there anything that Franklin had to say that stood out to you?
This is going to be another shameless plug, just because I'm very proud of what we do at Blue White Illustrated. Some of those comments, that the whiteout conversation, let's just take that, which was a large part of Saturday and why we were expecting about 15 minutes, and James went 21, almost 22 minutes, because we talked about the whiteout. Those comments were sort of benign. They were not benign when he was talking to Nate Bauer at Blue White Illustrated. So if you want to hear what he had to actually say and what he really wanted to get across, again, you can check out our site, because a lot of the conversation that's come from the whiteout is directly responding to that exclusive interview. So what he said on Saturday or on Thursday, not really. Yeah, there wasn't anything from that particular conversation about those things. I would say the most revealing part of the conversation was his comments on the captain vote, where he talked about they vote at the beginning of summer, before they break, who are the team captains. And if they don't get enough of a consensus, nobody's named a captain. And they did not get a consensus. And we know, based on his comments, that it's from a dearth of leadership, not because there are too many guys that are obvious leaders. So that continues. That issue continues. As much as we might want to say that Drew Aller is growing as a quarterback, he hasn't grown to the point that everyone is voting for him as the team captain. And not just to single him out. Trey Wallace, number one wide receiver. We're all expecting a good chunk of the offense to be him to be a focal point. I don't think we expect Nick Singleton at this point, just from his personality, to be a captain. But Tyler Warren, Nick Dawkins. Nick Dawkins. Everyone loves Nick Dawkins. Everyone thinks Nick Dawkins is, you know, the charismatic face and leader of not just the offensive line, maybe the offense, not a captain. So these things are, whatever reasons there are, and we don't know those reasons, it is a lingering issue. And going into an offense and defense transition, if you're not putting in the work, and this is not saying that they're not, this is just saying that you don't have obvious leaders leading from a player-led perspective. That is where they need to be buttoned up. And that could all be happening without one or two leaders. But it does raise the question, are they and can they dial in these offense and defensive schemes so that everyone's on the same page, so you don't have a repeat of what happened last year with the offense not being on the same page?
And I know, you know, your point is valid about they don't necessarily have the obvious leaders, but you went through on the offensive side the multiple candidates. You know, Nick Dawkins is an obvious candidate. Drew yep. Aller as the quarterback returning, it's an obvious candidate. Tyler Warren, again, a potential superstar at the tight end position. I'll even throw out Julian Fleming just in his role coming over as a veteran guy.
Yeah.
I'm getting some hints that he's kind of the driving force now in the wide receiver room. So it's not like they're completely void of potential leaders.
Yeah.
All right. A couple other notes that I found interesting. I don't think this was a surprise, but Tom Allen talked about the fact that he, as a coordinator, there's the choice of being on the sideline or up in the press box, and he said he would be on the sideline. I don't think there's any surprise there, T. Frank.
No, I didn't talk to him, so I was not a part of these conversations, so I don't know exactly how the questions were framed. But yeah, defensive coordinators are always on the sideline. Rarely. I guess Jim Knowles, again, going back to the Ohio State conversation, Jim Knowles is in the press box. But a lot of times, in order to facilitate the communication and kind of the understanding of what you're seeing from the player perspective, you need to be on the sideline. But with the helmet communication, that is a new question of how you're going to do it. But if you've been doing it one way for so long, and he's been on the sideline as the head coach, he's just comfortable there, I imagine, at this point. So, you know, those things don't matter until they do. That's the biggest thing I can say, is like, the offense was not working, so we had a conversation about Mike Yurcich coaching from the box or from the sideline, and then look at that. Manny Diaz coached a historically good defense from the sideline because that's where he coaches from. So a lot of it is preference. There are advantages to being in the press box. You can see the route combinations. You can see the different strategies that the offense is detailing. You get literally the all-22 view from that perspective, but then you miss other things. There's no slam dunk one way or the other. I think especially on defense, where it's a little bit more fluid than it is on the offensive side, where you need to see those coverage umbrellas and what the defensive plan for that game is quickly so you can adjust an attack.
I think also with Tom Allen, you pointed out he was a head coach, so he's on the sidelines. He's used to that. He's also, I think, a very emotional coach. I think he wants to be part of that emotion, which you can be on the sideline.
Yeah.
The other real quick note, Chuck Losey, some comments. He seemed pretty complimentary of Anthony Speca and Peter Gonzalez, two guys who came in late. I know at one point you were pretty high on Peter Gonzalez coming in. Any thoughts on those two players who just recently arrived?
It's just too early to tell. It's a great sign. He said that both of those guys were, you wouldn't know that they just got here a couple weeks ago because their baseline levels of athleticism and strength and all those things are higher than normal. They fit in really well. Peter's the one I think you would say Penn State needs to have something from, but he needs to learn the position. It's more about his positional skills than his athleticism.
All right, T. Frank, that is it for the show. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show.
Reputation is everything. Hi, I'm Matt Nobby, General Manager of Bobby Rahal Honda State College, and we're proud of the reputation we've built with our customers. We're not just here to sell you a new car. We support you through every mile of your Honda ownership with benefits like free state inspections and a complimentary loaner vehicle. We'll even wash and vacuum your car when it's in for service. Our reputation is car buying made simple and great service after the sale. Stop by our West College Avenue showroom today or go online at BobbyRahalHondaOfStateCollege.com.